you perceive a global pattern of negatives. She is flirtatious whenever we are out with other people. Or, he seems to have lost interest in me because last night we didn't talk much. Dichotomous thinking. You view events or people in all or nothing terms. Nothing seems to be going well in our relationship. Or, she never seems interested in being affectionate. Or, we are always arguing. Shoulds. You interpret events in terms of how things should be rather than simply focusing on what is. We should be excited and turned on to each other all the time. Or, my girlfriend should never find other people attractive and interesting. Personalizing. You take things personally in your relationship, as if anything done by your partner or others reflects on you. If she finds another man interesting, then that means I must be boring. Or, he was caught up surfing the internet. He's losing interest in me. Blaming. You focus on the other person as the source of your negative feelings, and you refuse to take responsibility for changing yourself. The reason I am upset is that she doesn't give me the attention I need. Or, he is trying to make me jealous by talking to another woman. Emotional reasoning. You let your feelings guide your interpretation of reality. I feel anxious, so that means that my partner is up to something. Or, I feel like things are boring, so that means my partner will look for someone more interesting and exciting. These automatic negative thoughts feed your rules or assumptions. If she likes someone else, then she will betray me. This confirms a core belief. I am unlovable. Here's how this might work. It is possible to have an accurate thought that your partner is thinking of another man that she finds attractive, because you have a rule that if my partner finds other men attractive, then she will betray me. You get anxious and angry. Your accurate thought may feed into a core belief about yourself that you are inadequate, less attractive, boring, or defective in some way. You become depressed and self-protective. Kevin is planning on going to a party with Stacy, his girlfriend, and her ex-boyfriend will be there. He thinks Stacy will find Alan to be really sexy. Fortune-telling, mind-reading. If she finds him sexy, then it means she thinks I'm inferior. Personalizing, mind-reading. I can't stand for her to think other men are sexy. Catastrophizing. I know Stacy broke up with Alan, and that she claims she loves me, but I can't count on that. Discounting the positive. If she left me, it would be the worst thing in the world for me. Catastrophizing. You can see how Kevin goes through a cascade of negative thoughts that lead him to conclude that she might dump him and go back to Alan, and if this happened, his life would not be worth living. Look closely at how your negative, biased thoughts may contribute to your jealousy. Worry and rumination. A fourth aspect of jealous thinking is relying on negative predictions about the future, worry, and dwelling on negatives from the past or present, rumination. Worry and rumination are similar processes and involve getting stuck on a negative thought. This is when we get hijacked by our thoughts. The thought appears, and we are taken along for a ride. You might have the negative thought, he finds that other woman attractive. And you could respond by dismissing the thought as irrelevant. Or, you might accept the idea that we all find many people attractive. With these responses, you don't get stuck on the thought, you let it go. But if you worry about it, your mind spins around like a wheel stuck in the mud. The more you think about what might happen, the more negatives come up. You begin thinking about how your partner might be more interested in someone else. You get more anxious and angry, and you can't get the thought out of your head. If you ruminate, you recall a negative in the past. I remember that at a party last month he was talking to Angie a lot, and you dwell on it, continually bringing it up in your head. Because we generally feel much worse when we worry or ruminate, why do we do it? We worry because we think it might help us. Worry is usually about what if, while rumination is often about why. When we are jealous, we think, I need to worry about the future in order to be prepared and not get caught off guard. Or we believe we need to ruminate because we will be able to figure things out and solve the problem. In this way, worry and rumination seem like strategies for coping with threats of rejection, betrayal, and abandonment. Jealousy can even be thought of as angry, agitated worry. The problem with repetitive worry is that it eventually leads to more anxiety and depression. It's like opening a file cabinet filled with the worst things that you can imagine, and then rummaging through it for hours. You are partnering with negatives, aligning your thoughts with them. It's like your moods, your thoughts, and your reality are all the same. You have a hard time stepping back, observing that a thought is just a thought or a mood that will pass. You are not only likely to feel much worse, but you are also likely to miss out on the positives in your life at the present moment. You can't enjoy your present life when you focus on imaginary negatives. Another problem is that you often worry because you cannot accept uncertainty. Not knowing for sure really bothers you. You think uncertainty means that something bad will happen, that it is a sign of something being hidden from you. Perhaps most importantly, you think that it's possible to get certainty. You might believe that if you keep thinking about it, then you will gain absolute certainty. But there is no certainty in an uncertain world. It is a fruitless and impossible quest that locks you into a repetitive, negative cycle. Each time you come up with the idea, I think I can trust him, you ask another question, but can I be absolutely sure? Then you reject any positives and go back to worry. In chapters 6, 7, and 8, we will look at a number of powerful techniques that you can use immediately to set aside these worries and get on with your life. Rumination, or dwelling on the negative, is similar to worry, but tends to focus on past events or asking yourself questions that never seem to have an answer, such as, why is this happening? Or, when will I ever feel better? People who ruminate are more likely to get depressed and stay depressed. When we ruminate, we often believe we can figure things out. Get all the information, make sense of everything, and get the complete picture. We keep spinning around asking ourselves or our partner unanswerable questions, then rejecting any answers we get as incomplete, unsatisfying, and even deceptive. Ruminating prevents us from participating in our lives. We do not enjoy what is going on right in front of us. We are seldom in the present moment where life is happening, and we are dredging up negative, unanswerable questions. Putting the jealous mind together. I began this chapter by describing the jealousy mode, and the jealous mind is one part of that mode. The other parts, which we will soon discuss, include your emotions, your behaviors, the ways you communicate, and your coping strategies. So let's put all aspects of the jealous mind together to help you understand the way you think first. We each start with some core beliefs about ourselves and other people. Let's say my core beliefs are that I am not good enough to be lovable and that others cannot be trusted. This is then coupled with rule books, which say that I have to be perfect to be loved, and my partner has to like everything about me. The idea is that if I try to be perfect, then my basic unlovability will not emerge and lead to rejection. My rule book about others says, other people are a threat to my relationship, or if my partner finds someone else to be attractive or interesting, then she will betray me. So I start looking for clues, discounting positives about my partner, and worrying about the future. Because I start with the core belief that I am not good enough to be lovable, the assumption follows that I must be perfect for my partner to stay with me. So I selectively focus on my imperfections, exaggerate the importance of them, and assume that this means my relationship is in jeopardy. Then I engage in mind reading. My partner thinks I'm boring. Personalizing. She yawned because she has lost interest. And fortune telling. She will find someone else. The jealousy mode keeps me locked into reinforcing my jealousy, testing my partner, doubting myself, and increasing my anxiety and anger. It's like stepping on the gas pedal and acting surprised that I am accelerating off a cliff. Another way of looking at our own jealous mind is to start with the negative biased thinking, our automatic thoughts, and then work down to our core assumptions. So, let's imagine that I think my partner is bored with me right now. Why would that bother me? After all of us are boring some of the time. Well, it bothers me because I then activate my rule book, which says I must be perfect to keep my partner's interest. It is the rule book and the assumption that gives intensity and importance to the negative thought. I sound boring. Perhaps if you didn't have that rule book, you could accept being boring some of the time. It's helpful to also look at why it would be so upsetting if my partner left me for someone else. Because I think I am unlovable, boring, and unattractive. She would confirm those beliefs by leaving. Whereas if I thought I was interesting and attractive, I might instead think, well, it would be very unpleasant if she betrayed me. Because I have qualities other women might want, I would find someone else. Once my core beliefs about myself and others are activated, my rule books are also activated. This leads me to activate my threat detection, looking for clues. She wasn't actually at her mother's house. Engaging in mind reading. Who is she thinking about? Or taking things personally? She is silent because she is bored with me. I then activate the coping strategies we will soon discuss. Worry, rumination, interrogating, testing, provoking, withdrawing, to find out what is really going on. My partner withdraws further from me, becomes angry with me, and this fuels my belief that things are falling apart. All of the thoughts, rules, and beliefs lead me to coping strategies that only make matters worse. Jealousy mode has taken over, and I am at risk of ruining my relationship. Core beliefs about the self. I am unlovable. Leads to rule books. I must be perfect to be loved. My partner has to like everything about me. Leads to biased thinking. I focus on my negatives. I discount any of my positives. Core beliefs about others. I can't trust people in intimate relationships. Leads to rule books. Other people are a threat to my relationship. If my partner finds someone else to be attractive or interesting, she will betray me. Leads to biased thinking. Mind reading. My partner finds him appealing. Personalizing. I must be losing my appeal. Fortune telling. She will betray me. Hijacked by emotions. Do you ever feel like Sarah? Her jealousy seems to overwhelm her at times. When Kent is gone on a business trip, I feel so lonely, so desperate, I just can't stand it. I keep imagining that he is flirting with other women, and then I feel this rush of anxiety, like I am going to go crazy. I don't know what to do. It's like this feeling comes over me in the pit of my stomach, and I don't know how to get rid of it. I don't have words to describe this feeling. It's like a terror. My heart is beating so rapidly, I want to cry. Sometimes I cry. I feel that I am losing control. Sarah's experience is not unusual. She feels overwhelmed with her feelings and realizes that she has so many different feelings. She thinks they are so intense that she will go insane. She fears that if she doesn't get rid of these feelings, they will escalate, get worse, and lead her to lose control. She feels bewildered, helpless, and overwhelmed. Jealousy is not simply being plagued by a set of thoughts or assumptions. In fact, your thought, my partner is interested in someone else, may be only part of the struggle going on in your mind. It's more likely you are bothered by all the emotions that go with the thoughts. These include anxiety that comes from uncertainty about what is happening, and fear of loss or betrayal. Anger, that you might be manipulated, humiliated, and treated unfairly. Confusion, because you don't know for sure what is going on. Ambivalence about your relationship, because you recognize that you love someone who might hurt you. These emotions may come to you in waves, one after another, sometimes ebbing, sometimes flowing, sometimes making you feel numb. You may think at times that you have no control over these emotions because they are so intense, so immediate, and so automatic. It's hard to imagine that these emotions might be temporary, that a few hours from now your emotions might be different. When you are in jealousy mode, you feel carried away by these emotions, as if there is nothing that you can do except follow them, be captured by them, and surrender to them. It's as if the present moment emotion rules you. You may lash out, withdraw, threaten, or say things that you later regret. It is these emotions, you think, that have driven you to say and do things that you may later wish you had never said or done. This experience is emotional hijacking, and it is frightening because you believe that you are a victim of overwhelming emotions. Sometimes it seems that your emotions don't make any sense. That what provoked a jealous rage turns out to be so minor when the reality eventually emerges later. Sometimes you think that if you don't understand why your emotions are so intense, it means you are helpless. What I don't understand, I can't control. Plus, when you experience these emotions, you think that they will go on forever. They will escalate to overwhelm you. You respond by saying to yourself, I can't stand having these feelings, and you think that you have to get rid of them immediately. And this emotional hijacking of your mind and heart leads you to interrogate, attack, withdraw, and threaten. See whether any of these thoughts about emotions are familiar to you. I can't stand these feelings. My feelings are going to drive me insane. No one else understands me. I shouldn't have these feelings. Other people don't have my feelings. Intense emotions are dangerous. There must be something wrong with me that I feel this way. I am embarrassed about these feelings. If I don't get rid of these feelings immediately, they will escalate. These feelings will go on and on and on. I must do something right now to get rid of these feelings. I can't accept these feelings. As you hear these statements, try to be honest about how you think. They reflect a wide range of problematic beliefs about emotion, including beliefs that your emotions, like anger, anxiety, sadness, and helplessness, are out of control, will last indefinitely, are different from the emotions of other people, don't make sense, and have to be eliminated immediately. Your emotions are blasting like a fire alarm that signals a catastrophe. But emotions are experiences that are going on inside you. The fire alarm is not the same thing as the fire. The emotions are crying out. Soon you will see how you can acknowledge every emotion that you have, validate your right to have whatever feeling that you feel, accept them for the moment, and step back and examine your thoughts, your feelings, your relationship, the events that are occurring, or that you suspect to be occurring, and the options available to you. For many of us, there is nothing so horrifying as emotional hijacking. You don't want to feel that your heart and mind can be taken over, and that your emotions can override your daily experience. But you can't eliminate your emotions, and you can't live without them. Certain things come with the territory. Where there is love, there is always the possibility of jealousy. You have seen so far how jealousy has evolved, how it is universal, how we find it in babies and animals. You are not alone. These emotions are intense. But like all emotions, they subside with time. It doesn't seem that way when you are hijacked. But what if you knew that whatever you feel in this moment, you will not feel at a later moment? What if you knew that all the things provoking your jealousy right now will be things you will feel indifferent about at a later time? Reflecting on past experiences of this is hard to access in the middle of emotional hijacking. But take a moment now and try to recall things that bothered you a few years ago. Has the intensity of your feelings about them subsided? In part 3, we will review a wide range of valuable and powerful techniques that you can use to help you cope with the intensity of emotional hijacking. We will develop a plan so that you can identify the triggers, step away from the situation, and acknowledge that the feelings are in the present moment. Then, you can consider options for disentangling yourself from the intensity and acting in your interest, not based on your emotions. You can start by validating your jealousy. It is a painful, overwhelming, difficult experience. You are not alone. This book was written for you to help you understand that these emotions are part of being human, and to help you see that another part of being human is being able to step away from emotion, not act on reflex, and keep options in front of you. When you are hijacked by jealousy, you may think that you are on a roller coaster, terrified and screaming as you rush down into the depths of your emotions. You think that this will go on forever, or that you are going to crash. It's like a catastrophe is exploding in front of you. But there are three ways to ride a roller coaster. Go along for the ride, slow it down, or get off. You have a choice. In the next chapter, we will review some of the problematic things that you say or do when you have these jealous thoughts and feelings. I call them strategies, because you may think that these responses to your jealousy will help you, or that you have no choice because you feel so overwhelmed. Then in chapter 6, we will look at how you can step away for a moment, step back, accept the feelings for the present, and live alongside the feelings and thoughts that previously hijacked you and carried you away. The emotions and thoughts will pass, but you will still be here. Chapter 5. Jealous strategies that drive your partner away. I thought he was probably flirting with Lily on his business trip, comparing me to her, and I was just so pissed off I couldn't stand thinking about him. So when he got home, I went after him. I was so angry I was afraid that he might dump me. I began accusing him of having an affair, telling him he was a lying bastard, yelling at him. He just looked bewildered. Then he said, "Sharon, Lily wasn't even there. She had to cancel her business trip because her kid was sick." I felt like I was crazy, and I have to admit, I have done a lot of things I feel guilty about. I checked the GPS in our car to see where he was driving. I wondered if he might be going over to see Lily when he left the house for several hours. I followed him to the health club because I knew that she belonged to a health club. I wasn't sure which one, though. I get these jealous feelings, and I just think I need to do something. I need to find out. I must be crazy. Like Sharon, you may be having a hard time accepting that you feel jealous, anxious, and angry, because you believe that these feelings will last a long time, they will escalate, and they will overwhelm you. You are afraid to let these feelings happen, so you think you need to do something. It's like you fear that you will drown in water, so you frantically slap at the water in a panic, but you begin to sink. In this chapter, we will look at a wide range of problematic strategies that you use. While I call these strategies, I don't want to imply that you are deliberately choosing these behaviors. They may seem to occur automatically. In fact, you may think that you have no choice in the matter. You might even think, "Of course I did that and said that. I was jealous." But you can get to a point in which you recognize that you are having an intense feeling. Then you can step away from the feeling, allow yourself a few minutes to reflect, and consider what you are about to do. Feeling is different from acting. We have looked at worry and rumination, a strategy that you might use to anticipate what is going on, predict the possible infidelity, and try to control things before they get out of hand. In later chapters, I will outline a wide range of techniques and adaptive strategies that you can immediately start using. But first, let's review some of the problematic strategies that you might be using now. With any strategy I describe, I am going to ask you to consider both the advantages and disadvantages of using it. I am not saying you should never do any of these things, only that you might want to consider the trade-offs, risks, and alternatives. Keep in mind that each response or strategy you have is a choice. So you want to be able to think about possible consequences and later think about alternatives to these choices. Interrogation. One strategy is to interrogate your partner. You question every detail about what happened. You want to know all the facts, and you think that the more information you are able to get out of your partner, the better things will be for you. You want to know for sure what is happening, and you think your partner is holding back. Your questions might be subtle, so you can see how your partner responds. So, did you have a good time with the people at that party? Anyone I know there? Or your questions could be more direct. Was Lily there? Did you talk with her? Or who was sitting next to you? Sometimes the interrogation can sound accusatory. Are you seeing someone? You might ask a series of questions, looking for more details, asking the same question but with different words, very much like an attorney. The more you question your partner, the more defensive he or she may become, telling you, "I haven't done anything wrong." You treat this defensiveness as evidence that they are hiding something. You keep at it, question after question. You have set up a prosecutor and defendant game where you are both prosecutor and judge. No matter what your partner says, you find them guilty. What are the costs and benefits of this approach? The costs include your partner's growing defensiveness, more arguments, and more distrust building between the two of you. Your partner feels attacked. You feel ignored and even manipulated. Continual interrogations might lead your partner to decide not to share things with you, because the questioning leads to escalation of arguments, stonewalling, deliberate withdrawal or evasion, or both. In some cases, the interrogation may become so unpleasant that the relationship disintegrates to the point of a breakup. The relationship ends not because of infidelity, but because of constant arguments that arise from constant questioning. You might consider some of the possible benefits of asking a lot of questions. Perhaps your partner is not telling you the truth and is hiding things from you. If your partner completely stonewalls and refuses to discuss anything, it may be possible that he or she is trying to keep you from the truth. For example, one woman told me that her partner would disappear overnight and then refuse to tell her where he was. She eventually broke it off with him. Looking for clues. As we discussed in the last chapter, a jealous mind gets set off by a belief that something is being hidden from you, and that your partner is trying to get away with something. Flirtations, secret meetings or communications, possibly an affair. But at this stage, you don't know. So you begin searching for any small sign that your partner is unfaithful or interested in someone else. We saw how Sharon would interrogate, search for clues, check her husband's GPS, but each time coming up only with more fuel for her checking and interrogating. Here are some more examples. You watch your partner's appearance. Is he or she looking more dressed up, more sexually provocative, more concerned with appearance? You wonder why he or she hasn't done that in the past, for you. You might sniff his or her clothing looking for fragrances of perfume, cologne, or smoke, whether he or she is not a smoker. You wonder where your partner has been, so you search the GPS in the car, or you try to get access to his or her phone. You look on social media to find out who your partner is friending on Facebook. Is he or she sending photos to anyone? If your partner is an hour late, you wonder whether it indicates that he or she has been out with someone. If your partner has been less interested in sex recently, you wonder whether it's evidence that he or she has found someone else. You might notice that your partner has been especially nice to you, so you wonder whether that is a manipulation to hide what is really going on. The disadvantage of continually looking for clues is that you are starting with an assumption about infidelity and then trying to prove that you are right. It's possible that anything less than perfection from your partner could be taken as evidence. You may selectively focus on small, insignificant details and blow them up into major issues. You engage in mind reading without sufficient reason to claim you actually know what your partner is thinking. Because anything can be taken as a clue, you discount and ignore any of your partner's positive behaviors. The more you look for clues, the less available you become for intimacy, relaxation, and pleasure, further alienating yourself from your partner. Of course, there are some possible benefits of looking for clues. Perhaps you will discover something that will unravel the truth, and you can know for sure that your partner is cheating. Ironically, there is no way of unraveling the truth that your partner is faithful, because your biased search for clues discounts any positive behavior as something insignificant, or even as a manipulation to hide the truth. All of this is a matter of balance and proportion. There is no way that searching for clues can turn out positively if it becomes a major preoccupation. You need to ask yourself whether this is really working for you, or whether this is creating more conflict, more distrust, more jealousy. Looking for signs that other people are interested in your partner. You scan the social environment to see whether someone else is interested in flirting with your partner. This is a version of looking for clues, but here you look for clues in the behavior of other people. You begin treating other people as competitors or even suspects. Is that woman looking at my husband? Is there something going on between them? Is that man smiling at my wife because he knows something that I don't know? You find yourself suspicious that your partner is talking with someone else, enjoying himself or herself, laughing. You feel enraged if someone touches your partner because it suggests that the other person feels some right to trespass on what you feel is rightfully yours. You might be really upset if you are at a party and your partner dances with someone else. Shouldn't she only be dancing with me? After all, she came here with me. This strategy was something that Sharon used quite often when she was out in public with her husband. If they were at a restaurant, she would look at how the waitress talked to him. Was she smiling at him? Was she talking with him more than with Sharon? Were there other women in the restaurant looking in his direction? The disadvantage of this strategy is that socializing can become a competition between you and other people, often people you don't even know. You will be less likely to enjoy time with your partner because you will be looking for threats from everywhere. In some cases, you might begin preventing the two of you from socializing with other people. You might believe that this strategy has some advantages. You may think you will be able to catch the secret of flirting, or the people who might threaten your relationship, and then confront your partner with this information to keep things from getting worse. The problem, of course, is that you are likely to have a lot of false alarms, which will lead to an escalation of conflict that might, ironically, drive you and your partner apart. Is this strategy actually helping you? Pouting and withdrawing. With this strategy, you silently and subtly decrease your interactions with your partner. You say to yourself, let him try to figure out what is going on. You don't show any affection, don't talk as much, don't laugh anymore. You withdraw. Sometimes you aren't around and sometimes you don't respond to his or her calls and texts. You want your partner to know how it feels to miss you, to want to punish him or her. But you don't want to admit that this is your intention. When your partner asks you what is wrong, you deny that there is anything wrong. After all, if he or she really cared, really loved you, she would just know what's wrong. But she doesn't know. You get to make your partner feel bad Maybe, you hope, make him or her feel guilty. And you set up a test to see whether he or she really cares about you. And your partner fails the test. This is what Sharon would do to express her anger with her husband. It allowed her to be hostile by being passive-aggressive. And she didn't have to openly acknowledge that she was hostile. When her husband would ask her what was wrong, she would deny that anything was wrong, which would confuse him and lead him to withdraw. The disadvantage of pouting and withdrawing is that it is hard to see how your relationship gets better with this strategy. If you are afraid that your partner is losing interest, pouting and withdrawing is even more likely to drive him or her away. The idea of testing to see whether your partner cares might backfire because they might view your behavior as unreasonable and unrewarding. On the other hand, you might believe that pulling away from your partner will help you find out whether he or she really cares about you. It could be possible for him or her to initiate contact and try to get closer to you, but it is more realistic to build connections based on positive behavior, like suggesting that you do some positive things together. Do you think that withdrawing, pouting, and being unavailable will build a relationship? Accusing. You directly accuse your partner of an indiscretion or of being unfaithful. Have you been seeing her, or did you have sex with him? You don't necessarily know for sure what is going on, but you think you need to get your suspicions out in the open. When your partner denies any wrongdoing, you treat this denial as a false pretense. He or she is lying, trying to evade responsibility. You might even try making up accusations, some of which you know are unfounded. But you want to see what kind of response you get from your partner. Does he look guilty? Does she say something that gives her away? You might believe the angry thoughts that come to mind can't be stopped, so you must get them out by speaking them. I've got to tell you what I really think. You might call your partner a liar, a cheat, a coward, for not owning up and declare that he or she doesn't deserve you. Once you start the accusations, you won't back down. You must prove that you are right. No matter what your partner says, you will keep at it. Sharon had accused her husband of being interested in other women, of flirting, and even of being unfaithful, even though she admitted to me that she had no solid evidence, and that her husband seemed to be an honest man. She just felt so overwhelmed by her emotions at the time. Look, I just felt so pissed off I couldn't help myself. I had to say what was on my mind. She was experiencing emotional hijacking and was overwhelmed by thoughts and feelings. So she just let it all out with accusations. Later, when she felt less upset, she reflected on what she had said to her husband. I feel so embarrassed. He hadn't done anything to deserve this. I just lost control. The disadvantage of the accusation strategy is that it is likely to drive your partner further away and drive you further away. You will feel more angry, anxious, and jealous when you start a string of accusations. This is not to say that you shouldn't confront your partner with the facts if the facts do indicate that something is going on. But if you make a rash accusation, then both of you will remember it for quite some time, and it will be hard to recover. You might think that there are some advantages. Maybe your partner will confess, and then you will know for sure. Or, alternatively, maybe your partner will prove that he or she is totally faithful. But how often have you seen the positive side of the accusation strategy? Do relationships improve because of accusations? Derogating the competition. When you derogate the person you think you are competing with, you hope to show your partner that he or she is better off with you. You claim that the other person is not as attractive, not as smart, not nearly as successful as you. He or she is boring, can't be trusted, is dishonest, even disgusting. You may say things like, "She's an idiot, you know that. All she's interested in is advancing her career. He's always screwing around on his wife. He can't be trusted with my wife." "I can't believe you would find her interesting. She's so boring." "He has lost one job after another." Your rationale is that if you can convince your partner that the other person is inferior, then he or she won't be interested. And you also hope to find out whether your partner will defend the other person, which you will interpret as a sign that he or she is indeed interested. The more you derogate the other person, the more likely your partner might be to disagree with you, which adds fuel to your suspicions. Any defense of the other person or unwillingness to join your attacks can only mean that your partner prefers the other person to you. The disadvantage to this strategy is that your partner might start viewing you as irrational, hostile, unfair, or petty, further alienating the two of you. It doesn't build a strong positive bond. Even if your partner does agree that the other person is undesirable, your derogation can make you sound like a judgmental person who will go on the attack. This is not likely to help your relationship. You might hope that your partner will see the light, recognizing that the other person is truly undesirable and that he or she is better off with you. But ask yourself how you would feel if your partner derogated someone you like through an innocent friendship or respect such as a colleague. You might become defensive as well. Derogating your partner. When you decide to derogate your partner, you hope to form such a convincing case for defectiveness and inferiority that he or she feels lucky to have you and unworthy of attracting anyone else. Your hope is to show your partner that there are no options other than you. You might point out that your partner is a liar, a cheat, an idiot, and ugly. He or she may have declining sexual abilities or be less attractive than ever before. Sharon acknowledged that there were times when she would go after her husband, pointing out his shortcomings, suggesting that he had lost his looks, insisting he was difficult to get along with and ornery a lot, and saying sex wasn't so good. The implication was, why would anyone else want him? Another way you could derogate your partner is to tell him or her all the terrible things that would happen if you did separate. "You won't have any money. I won't let you see the kids. You will be alone forever." You're cutting off all viable alternatives by convincing him or her of being a loser with no options. Derogating your partner could also be a punishment for being interested in someone else. By labeling him or her as undesirable, you hope to impart the lesson that if he or she does anything to provoke your jealousy, then there will be a price to be paid. The disadvantages of this approach? It will likely drive you and your partner further apart, and it may lead to retaliation, or at least defensiveness. You are not likely to build a strong case that a relationship with you is the desirable alternative. If your partner views you as punitive and hostile, then it could lead to a breakup, not because of a threat from someone else, but because your hostility has driven the two of you apart. You are less likely to return to warmth, closeness, and trust. Your hostility can become far more significant to your partner than the positives in the relationship. You might think derogating your partner will send clear messages. No one can take you for granted, and no one can get away with anything. By exercising power and control, you think you will keep your partner. But that might backfire, because it is very plausible that he or she could leave you over this hostility. Threatening to terminate the relationship. When your suspicions get more intense, you may test your partner by threatening to end the relationship if his or her behavior doesn't change. You may threaten to leave, throw him out, or never see her again. You may walk out and not contact him. Let him worry, let him stew like you have been stewing and suffering. Your ultimatums may sound like this: "If you do this again, I will leave you, You will never see me again. In some cases, you might leave the house to get away from your partner, to threaten him or her with the idea that it all could end. If you have discovered a real infidelity, it might seem like a sufficient reason to walk out and threaten to end the relationship. But many people are able to rebuild relationships after an affair has been discovered. It's hard, but possible, if both partners work on it. It is up to you to decide. There are some disadvantages to threatening to end the relationship. If you don't follow through on the threat, it may lead your partner to treat your concerns as empty threats. He or she will not take them seriously. You can lose credibility. This may even cause you to feel the need to escalate conflict even further, just to establish the credibility of your concerns. Your threats can also lead your partner to make his or her own threats. Your threat to leave might lead your partner to leave. There is high reciprocity for negative behavior, as it tends to lead to negative responses from the other person. Think of a threat to leave the relationship as a last resort. There are many more adaptive and less risky strategies that we will discuss later in the book. You might think there are advantages to threatening to terminate the relationship. By adding to the cost, you may hope to motivate your partner to take your concerns seriously. You may have expressed these concerns many times in calmer ways, but your partner may continue to ignore them. You might believe that you can no longer tolerate your partner's behavior, and you would be better off and suffer less if you ended the relationship. You may think the only way to handle the intensity of your anger and anxiety is to threaten to leave, which might give you short-term relief. No one can tell you that you should or should not terminate a relationship. I tend to think that it is important to consider as many other options as you can. That is, of course, what this book is about. Have you tried all the other options yet? Increasing the cost to your partner. You may be using threats or punishment to reduce any freedom of movement that your partner might have. You might indicate that if he or she left you, you would get all the money, you would keep the kids from them, you would ruin their reputation, or you would flaunt your own freedom by having sex with people you both know. You may make it clear that if he or she continues a current behavior, you might threaten to escalate the conflicts, tell family members, withhold sex, or not see them. You might anticipate that their behavior could lead to a breakup initiated by either of you. With this control option, you have raised the threat level. In some cases, you might end up threatening violence against your partner, against yourself, or both. You think that increasing the cost will keep him or her attached to you, too frightened to leave, so he or she never will. What are the disadvantages of this control strategy? As intense and uncomfortable as your emotions might be, trying to control people by threats is seldom a winning strategy in maintaining a relationship. One woman told me that she was so afraid of her partner's jealousy that she would sneak around to see people and was planning to secretly move out of state to escape her husband's threats. It's not possible to control people for very long. While this strategy may give you the sense that you are going to get what you want, it is also likely to alienate your partner even more. He or she may break up with you, not because of another person, but because your partner doesn't want to be controlled and threatened by you. Also, this strategy keeps you vigilant and anxious because you are trying to control what is uncontrollable, what someone else thinks, feels, and does. Some advantages you might perceive include knowing what is going on, keeping things from unraveling, and showing your partner that no one can treat you this way. These concerns make sense in a way, but trying to control someone with threats and punishment may not give you those advantages. Your partner may be more likely to become secretive, withdraw, counterattack, or even leave. The very goals that you want to achieve may be undermined. You cannot control the freedom of another person, and it's not likely that you would want a relationship based on that kind of control. Maybe there is a better way. Trying to make your partner jealous. You may find out whether your partner is really committed to you by seeing whether he or she becomes jealous when you flirt with or show interest in someone else. You might openly flirt in front of your partner, tell him that you are going to see someone else, or let her know that you are thinking about one of your exes. Or you might become secretive and hope that he or she gets jealous, wondering why you are not available or not responding. If we think our partners are jealous, we tend to conclude that they are committed to the relationship and that they truly care. However, this is a high-risk strategy and can backfire. Your partner might justify his behavior by saying that you are doing the very same thing. Why should you complain about him if you are flirting or seeing other people? Another possibility is that your partner might conclude that she cannot trust you and may then begin to distance herself from you or even threaten to leave. Your partner may view your behavior as openly manipulative and insulting, then back away, leading to the very thing that you most fear, the end of the relationship. You might think that this strategy offers an advantage, a test for finding out what kind of relationship your partner is after. If there's no jealousy on display, you might think that he or she doesn't really want a committed relationship, so you might want to reconsider your own commitment. My view is that this strategy is a high-risk one, because people often act in unintentionally destructive ways when they're provoked. Hedging your bets. This is a less direct strategy in which you look for alternatives to your partner. When one woman was feeling distrustful of her boyfriend, who was often unavailable, she began seeing a married man on the side. Because she was getting needs for sex and communication met by the married man, she felt less of a need to get those things from her boyfriend. As a result, she expressed less jealousy with the boyfriend, but felt stuck in limbo between two unappealing alternatives: a boyfriend who had become withdrawn, or a married man unable to commit to her. Her self-esteem sank further. Sometimes when people are jealous, they begin revisiting former lovers. They think, just in case this current relationship doesn't work, I can probably see that person again. This serves as a hedge, an insurance policy in their minds. The problem with the hedging strategy is that neither alternative is likely to get better. As you withdraw and become secretive, closeness diminishes with your current partner. You are compartmentalizing yourself, and you may expend a lot of energy hiding your secret life. Another disadvantage is that you may get caught. How would it work out when you have expressed jealousy, but then are exposed as the one who is cheating or hiding things? The hedging strategy may make you feel less threatened by loss should a breakup occur. It might help boost your self-esteem for the moment, knowing that someone else is interested. It might seem that you have an insurance policy, a fallback position. Those are understandable concerns, and it might make you feel like you are more in control for a time. But think about whether you have known anyone who said, "I built a stronger relationship with my partner by hedging my bets." My guess is, you haven't. Is your strategy working? We've examined some of the more common strategies that you might be using when you feel jealous. Perhaps you use more than one of these strategies, or even some that are not in this chapter. Ask yourself what you hope to accomplish with your strategy, and consider whether it is in your long-term interest. You might think that you don't have a choice, but you do. By thinking through each of these strategies, you can consider whether it is the only way, let alone the best way, to build respect, trust, and love. Each of these strategies has a rationale that might make sense and, in some cases, might be helpful. We always believe something positive will result from our negative behavior. But each of these strategies has a potential downside, so you need to weigh the risks. You are not the only one acting on jealous strategies. Many people do these things. As you will learn in the following chapters, there are other techniques and strategies that might be more helpful. They also might have less of a downside. After all, who wants a relationship to end because of the strategy used in an attempt to keep it together? Part 3. Turning Jealousy Around. Chapter 6. Stepping Back to Observe and Accept. Now that you know how your jealous mind operates with emotions that overtake you, and how you cope by interrogating, seeking reassurance, and looking for clues, we are ready to explore some new, more powerful and helpful ways to live. You will learn how to step back and observe jealousy without getting hijacked. Recognize the difference between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and talk back to the negative, overwhelming thoughts that seem so true in the moment. We can make room for jealousy without feeling crowded out by it. It helps to accept that all of us are flawed and imperfect, and that we all have difficulties. With this acceptance, we can live in the real world. How can I stop feeling this way? In jealousy mode, our thoughts and feelings get stormy. It's like we are caught in a tornado, being tossed around in winds of fear, anger, confusion, and sadness. Thoughts jump at us and take us over. We feel we have no self-control, no ability to get out of the storm. The blaring thoughts and terrifying emotions suck us in, and we often feel there is no chance for escape. Karen said, "I feel like I am possessed by some force beyond my control." When he tells me that he was at a party and ran into his ex-girlfriend, I feel overwhelmed with every horrible emotion that I could ever imagine. I want to scream. What the hell is wrong with me? We seem to think our lives should be free of jealousy, anger, anxiety, sadness, and resentments. We should be happy all the time. But life is filled with frustrations and disappointments that can be rough to ride at times. Life is not always going to be the way we want it to be. Sometimes we want emotional perfectionism, to be content, at peace, happy, and secure. But life doesn't work that way for us, and it doesn't work that way for anyone. When a painful feeling comes along, we get wrapped up in it, as if it's the only feeling we will ever have. Our emotional perfectionism tells us that things shouldn't be this way. Because we are hijacked, we think we must get rid of these feelings, banish these thoughts, and clear our minds and hearts. We want peace, clarity, and certainty. Without this tranquility, which seems perpetually beyond our reach, we feel we are lost. But as we struggle more to get rid of these internal experiences, we feel even more helpless and confused. We don't know where to turn. The storm keeps churning inside our heads and our jealous hearts. Alone and embarrassed, you ask, "How can I stop feeling this way?" You think there is no way to live with these thoughts and feelings. You may even think that in order to stop the storm, you need to end the relationship. But you love this person and don't want to lose him or her. After all, isn't keeping your partner what the jealousy has been about from the beginning? In this chapter, we explore how you can live with thoughts and feelings, even ones that you don't like, without getting hijacked. It's like learning to tolerate the crazy uncle who shows up for a holiday dinner. You stand back, observe, but don't engage. By noticing, observing, and accepting, you can live with the background noise in your head without jeopardizing the relationship that you value. Making room for jealousy. Don't assume the jealousy needs to disappear. Allow it to be there without taking over. Allow it to be what the two of you can accept for the moment. Allow it to nag you, annoy you, or scare you without taking over everything. Think of the jealousy as alarms sounding, many of them false alarms.